All right, this episode was so much to cover that we've actually broken it up into 2 days. And so this is the start of day two. Yesterday we talked a lot about how Sean got into telemedicine and leading as the what was your position at MUSC?
So I started as the director of telehealth, and then when I left, I was the administrator of telehealth.
Great. So you were very much on the administrative operations, making sure things up and running. So great insights there. And we talked about the whole from 2013 all the way up to, we didn't really touch on COVID. That's what we'll talk about today. So COVID was just a completely out of the world experience for anybody that's in the telemedicine space. And talk about what that experience was like from your perspective as an administrator of telehealth for a large health system. What was the first indication that something was happening? What were the conversations like with the leadership and the C-suite? And what was your experience like leading this? And I'm pretty sure there are a lot of sleepless nights. So tell us about that.
Yeah, no, it was an extremely busy time period for us when, we had a provider, Dr. Ed O'Brien, who was leading our virtual urgent care, who did a lot in global health. So he was early on when things were, about to hit U.S., I think, or maybe just hit U.S. soil. He was like, this is the real deal. This is going to blow up. We need to prepare, And so there was a sense of urgency in our center before there was, overall within the state of South Carolina. But even then, still didn't fully appreciate what we were about to endure. Because I remember I took the initial lead of like, hey, let me take the point on this. This is pretty important. I was about to go to a conference. I was like, I think I'm a cancel going down. And I think it was like HIMSS or something. I was like, I'm not going to go.
Yeah,
I'm not going to go. I was like, I better just stay here and let's figure this out. And I started to put some things together. And it was probably within the first 5 days of planning, I was like, I think we need all of our leaders. We got to start separating and delegating things out because we realized that there was going to be different entry points and it was going to be way more like it wasn't going to be manageable for someone to say, hey, I'll just handle COVID. It was going to be like pieces out. We started, after like a week or so, we started realizing this is going to completely change the way, we're going to be delivering care. People are going to be accessing and stuff. So we started separating and we had a big mapped out strategy, a pandemic response strategy, leveraging our existing tools that we already had. We had thoughts like, hey, we'll use this for this, we'll use that for that. So we had kind of the virtual urgent screening, which I got heavily involved in. We had, when patients come to the hospital, how are we going to keep our staff safe and still be able to treat patients? So we had a hospital strategy around it. We had all the patients that go to ambulatory care clinics, we actually had a clinic, that MUSC had that they closed down because of an exposure early. So it was the mindset of like, we're going to be flipping, pretty much all of ambulatory care virtual. So there had to be an ambulatory care strategy. So there's different pieces, there was a remote patient monitoring strategy that developed of, all right, when patients are positive and either they're not sick enough to be hospitalized or maybe they get discharged, how do we monitor them? Kind of that hospital at home model to make sure that, we have some involvement. So there was different things broken off. Things just lit like a fire in the early stages.
And what things went really well, better than you expected?
I don't know if it was better than I expected. I think, probably the biggest thing would be that for the very first time, we had every single person within our organization, and this is true for any health system during that time period, where everybody had the exact same priority. Mm. So it wasn't anything in regards to, hey, I gotta see if I can get a meeting with legal this month, to ask them about this, new law. It was, I had the full, the whole full legal team saying, Sean, we will review every single thing that comes up in regards to evolving state regulations, federal regulations, as this emergency evolves, we will give you, updates and we can make decisions from there. And I'm like, Wow, that's fantastic. Because it was you. It was typically myself reading all the stuff that might come every couple months or whatever, and then having my interpretation, and then you know getting a meeting and saying, "Hey, am I interpreting this correctly? You know, what does this mean for our service?" But it was, you know, everyone else was getting out in front, which was phenomenal to have everybody kind of rowing in the same direction and to realize, you know, what an organization can accomplish in such a short period of time when you have that type of strategic alignment. And I would also say early, you know, I still have it in my phone written down. It was within the first week, but I remember I put it in my phone, which people often would, you know, say during the early times of, you know, never, you know, whatever is by, you know, never let a crisis go to waste type of situation. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know, and so I was thinking about that early because I was like, we were trying to get a lot of things going with remote patient monitoring in regards to compliance, EHR build. And we had conversations. It is even before we realized how big COVID was going to be. It was like, man, we can get all this stuff built for us. We've been trying to get built for like the last 2 years. And then we'll just use it for like COPD and CHF and all these other, you know, chronic conditions. And so that really kind of moved things along at a rapid pace. So we were already thinking about that. Like, how can we benefit from an infrastructure that will give us long-term, you know, sustainable, you know, benefits downstream, which it definitely did.
Yeah, you know, definitely. I mean, that's, I think so many people have seen that, just everybody got aligned behind it, and barriers that existed before no longer existed anymore. Now, talk about some of the, what were some of the mistakes or failures that you experienced during COVID that you're looking back, you're like, ah, oh, I guess we could have done that different.
Yeah, I don't know if it would be mistakes. I think it was just, you know, we would discover quick inefficiencies and then try to address them right away. You know, I mean, one of the first, you know, MUSC was one of the first, if not the first on the East Coast to virtualize the screening directly into the drive-through, right? And so we had a lot of success with, you know, virtual urgent care. Well, we were doing about 3,000 virtual urgent care visits a month in January and February, 3,000 to 4,000. And quickly, you know, we modified the platform to be able to screen for this asynchronously. So, you know, and at that time, you'll hear about some of the big telehealth players were having trouble with the demand that was coming at them because they were using, you know, the traditional either video or telephone interaction, which could take 10 to 12 minutes to make an assessment. Are you high risk where you need additional testing? Where we were able to do that in like 68, I think it was like 89 seconds was what was determined. 89 seconds per encounter, we will say, yes, you're high risk. You were outside of the country. You were high risk. You had a direct exposure, you know, to someone who was COVID-19 positive. And then we continue to develop a more streamlined system to get them into a drive-through clinic. You know, at first it was, you know, manual processes between the two, you know, like we had the system and then like people would go through like who was got the order, and then it was getting that into the electronic health record. Then we were able to get that order directly into electronic health record to speed that up. Once they got tested, one of the clinical departments early on was calling every single person who got tested and telling them, hey, you were positive, or you know, even calling negatives and saying, you know, you were negative, you're, you know, good, all this other stuff. And, you know, think about the demand that was coming through. You're talking about hundreds a day eventually coming through, getting tested, hundreds and hundreds. And next thing, you got a big backlog, you know, because they're taking forever to have this, you know, could be a 5-7 minute conversation with each individual. So notifying 100 patients that they're negative would take you all day. Now they have a huge, now they're like 4 days behind. We were able to use a tool that we were working on around this prenatal post maternal health situation, where we were going to push information out to text messages to a mother of prenatal information, and then postpartum be able to check on the health of the mental health of the mother, check on how the baby was doing with progression, check on do they have resources, adequate food, you know, all those different things around the mother baby time period. And we hadn't launched that yet. But we ended up flipping that application that we were working on developing and used that as a notification tool of text messages in regards to, you know, they were still, you know, reaching out directly for positives. Right, right. But all of a sudden, as opposed to taking 8 hours to notify 100 patients that they were negative, we were able to do that in a couple minutes, you know? And so just like that type of, so it was things like that. It was like, we would learn things like, oh no, don't do that. Like, we got it. There's a more efficient way. So we continue to identify more ways to make things more efficient throughout, you know, throughout the different time.
And at the beginning of COVID, everybody went to telemedicine, and very, very few things were done in person, except, you know, actual COVID cases or emergency type care. And then it started to trickle back, slowly coming back in. What did you see as people were starting to go back? It wasn't just a light switch. You just switch on, everybody comes back in person. You started to see that creep back up. What were you seeing in the change of attitude and perception about telemedicine as a result of COVID? And what were the preferences that you were seeing from patients and providers after having the opportunity to do telemedicine and seeing how it could be done?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a mix, and it depended on a lot of different things of the, you know, digital literacy of the patient population. There's a lot of discussion on that right now and needs to improve that throughout our country. Whether it's an aging population, patients in rural locations, same thing with our providers, you know, providers that weren't able to use the technology. I think that became an interesting time period for a lot of health systems that may have had an investment on a certain technology and said, hey, this is our solution. And maybe they were using it for different reasons for telehealth. And then when they had to use it for getting into the homes, it wasn't super user friendly. Your platform is a great example of a super user friendly platform that people were able to, hey, this works a lot easier, you know, and people were adopting it easier. And so that's when I think the mentality shifted of like, you know, let's not make this too complex. It's got to be easy for the patient to use. It's got to be easy for our provider to use, because a lot of health systems, unfortunately, set people up, not intentionally, but they set them up to fail of saying, hey, here's the technology, because they had to do everything so quickly. Here's the technology. They would push that out to their providers, tell them how to do it, and then sit back and like, oh, I hope this works, you know, without the, you know, so they took away the kind of pre-visit assistance that you would typically have, you know, at the front office when someone would come into an ambulatory visit. They took out the, you know, the nurse or the CMA, who's not only there to get vitals, but often there to help the provider navigate other things. Like, where's this chart? Where's this information? You know what I mean? There are just so much things that go on in the clinic that I think got lost during that time period, which made providers frustrated, you know, rightfully so. And so, you know, it was interesting, like, especially after, you know, 6 months in the pandemic, and people were like, oh, we're doing telehealth now. Like, we've got this. And I'm like, because we knew, a lot of people knew that, like, well, they were set up in a rush without a clear strategy, clear training, clear way to how to do this. And within 6 months, all of a sudden, maybe even less than that, you started hearing providers. Now we've got providers using multiple different systems. We've got, you know, just there was, everything started to break down for a lot of health systems, and they realized, you know what, okay, we did flip things virtual. People were very adaptive at first. You know, I think that's the thing. There was a lot of grace that was given by both the patient population and the providers at first that you typically would not get in a telehealth implementation. Right. You know what I mean? The patients, you know, typically, if something went wrong with the technology, they'd be like, oh, this is horrible. But, you know, if something went wrong, they're like, hey, I'm just glad I have a safe way to see you, you know? And the same way with the providers, if something went wrong, they might have been really frustrated, but they're like, hey, this is what I got right now to reach my patient population. I'm grateful that I have this. So there's a lot of grace, but, you know, that wears off after a while, you know? And so you start to see that where people start to revisit, like, well, you know what, we probably need to relook at what we did because it was done in such a rush, and let's think more strategically. Let's think of the development tasks that need to be accounted for with, you know, compliance with billing and everything else. You know, of course, a lot of the regulations got lifted, you know, during that time period, which was nice, you know, that people can scale quickly. But the sooner people started to think about, all right, what's the long-term sustainability? How do we create this, build this to last? The better, and people start to move on from there.
You know, you mentioned that 6 month mark where I think very much so the first 6 months is like, whatever, we just got to be using things. And then about the 6 month mark, people were like, hey, this COVID thing is not going away. let's like figure out how to optimize this and do it right. And they started thinking about, does it make sense to be going through all these steps? Or maybe we should like get a contract with this, whatever, and do it. Did you see a difference in, like, what were the biggest requests that people had as they were kind of adapting to this new normal? What were their biggest pain points that they were struggling with?
A lot was around IT support, you know, or education, you know, from the provider side of things, you know, that making sure that they had someone who's going to, you know, typically when we would implement telehealth services in the past, there was a lot of handholding. And when you had to do this big at scale so fast, we lost that handholding, you know, and you know, so I think that was the time point of like, all right, we need to revisit this. And we start, you know, at the center, we started to strategically think about like our resource, personnel resources and how we could divvy things back out to have, you know, key people, operational people that can work with different service lines. So they had a key contact, you know, to be able to say, all right, here's the resources, but we're also going to give you a clear point of contact, because a lot of jobs got reshuffled, right? Like, I mean, we had school-based telehealth nurses that the, you know, school shut down. So, but we had a skill set. So we shuffled them into virtual urgent care and reviewing things. We had them review, you know, some that didn't come through the platform like initially, but, cause when we set that up, I mentioned like we were doing like a couple, 3,000 a month, January, February, we ended up doing 32,000 a month in March, you know, and we set that up. It was like, all right, now we got to say, we got those through. I remember our chief diversity officer, Anton Gunn, shout out to Anton. He was like, Sean, this is great, but I need, can Spanish speaking patients get through this? You know? And I'm like, no. So we set that up in like less than a week where they had a route, and we worked with Dr. Vanessa Diaz and had a route for Spanish speaking patients to come through and get evaluated. And I remember just like, you know, we did it in less than a week. I was super, super happy. And I was like, man, this is great. Anton, I got you, you know, Spanish speaking route. He goes, fantastic. I need something for someone who doesn't have internet, you know, at all. And I'm like, give me a minute, you know? And, so we set up a, you know, a phone line option for someone who would not have internet access or couldn't get to a device to be able to use virtual urgent to get through a screening. We use our school-based telehealth nurses to be the ones that would screen for that. So there's a lot of like moving around, you know, personnel during that time as well. It was just such a fluid and dynamic, you know, time. But exciting time, you know, it was just like, you know, a lot of people learned a lot. Obviously, the industry got pushed forward, you know, people would say whatever, 5-10 years in such a short period of time, which is definitely the truth. But, you know, now it's like, hopefully, like people learn from those lessons and start to push themselves even forward and not just go back to kind of an old school, you know, way of thinking.
You know, you mentioned that the industry got moved forward 5 to 10 years in a matter of months. And kind of your job at MUSC was to expand and get to this point where telemedicine was ubiquitous. And ta-da, it happened. You did it. And is that feeling that, hey, you cross a line, you finish that, is that kind of you're like, you know what? I have mission accomplished here at MUSC. I'm looking for my next challenge. Is that what prompted you to move on to your next thing?
Not completely, but maybe. I don't know. Maybe subconsciously it did. You know, I think, you know, I got approached about a position, you know, and it was in correctional healthcare. And my first thought was, you know, there's stigmatism around correctional healthcare, and I don't see, I'm happy where I'm at. Yeah. But I had a former mentor always said, never pass up a conversation. And that first conversation was with my now boss. He's an ER physician, great, phenomenal guy, great vision. And his vision was, hey, listen, correctional healthcare has been done a certain way of a kind of a centralized business model, decentralized clinical care. And I want to change that. I want to redesign the way care is delivered using telehealth, other digital health applications to be able to, you know, improve the efficiency of the way care is delivered, improve access, improve, you know, the cost effectiveness of the way we deliver care, to standardize the way care is delivered for this extremely vulnerable population, overlooked population. And I'm like, you're speaking my love language right now. So I'm now, you've now got my attention. And that changed a lot of things. And, you know, and having conversations with folks at MUSC, you know, it was the whole mission thing came up, like, is a mission accomplished? I was like, you know what? I don't know if the mission will ever be accomplished. You know what I mean? I could do this for another 20 years. I don't think the mission's accomplished, but I think I grabbed the baton when I did back in 2013, and I ran pretty far, and I think it was at a point where I was ready to pass it on to somebody else, mm-hmm. to come with new ideas and new thoughts and take it even further than I could have taken it. And then, give myself another mission, another journey, which where I can impact another population. Because, you know, I mentioned about the stigmatism. I've had friends, growing up that were in the system, you know, visiting friends in jail when I grew up outside Pittsburgh, visiting a friend that spent years in the Pennsylvania DOC. And so I had that personal connection too around that. And I'm like, you know what, if I just sit on the sidelines and say, yeah, that's, you know, people talk about the care and corrections, and I actually have been given an opportunity, I've been presented an opportunity to actually make a positive impact on that. And I knew my skill set and what I potentially could contribute to that. I mean, what could I say about myself if I didn't jump at that opportunity and say, yeah, I'm going to jump in the ring and I'm going to see what I can do and hopefully contribute to make some positive changes in the care we deliver.
Well, you certainly have the background, the skill set to make a difference. What is, you've got that vision of improving things. What are some of the specific strategies that you guys are looking to do and roll out to, and what are the outcomes you're looking to achieve?
Yeah, I mean, some of the big things in correctional healthcare, you know, like I said, there's correctional healthcare gets a lot of a bad rap. It's interesting because of the Eighth Amendment, our patients, inmates, people, justice-served population, actually have a guaranteed right to healthcare, which is very unique from anybody else. You and myself do not have a guaranteed right, right? There's always the debate, is it a right, is it a privilege? Well, as of right now, it is a privilege. No one has the right outside the walls of a correctional facility. You might get it from your employer or anything else, but a lot of people that don't have it, right? It's not a right. But justice-served populations are protected where they do have a right to healthcare. So that brings a very litigious environment. It's a very challenging environment because of, you know, of course, people talk about understaffing everywhere else in healthcare. Typically, a lot of facilities are challenged as well with staffing problems. And you've got patients who, you know, are in a housing unit, mm-hmm. and they have to be transported by, you know, custody, correctional officers, to a clinic area to receive care. And if there's a shortage of correctional officers and they can't transport them, then we cannot provide that care, you know. But we get caught up in that as well. So, you know, when I first heard about that, the internal mobility challenges of, you know, that. So, you know, my thought there, and this is something we're not doing, you know, robustly yet or anything, but trying to put strategies around. I'm like, listen, if patients need to come to the clinic area to receive care, and we know that that mobility is a challenge, getting them from their housing unit, then we need to rethink our strategy and we need to figure out how to get that care into the housing unit, you know, as best as we can. So we're looking at those types of things of how could we bring care to the patient? You know, again, typically you would do in the community. What are your challenges? What are your barriers? What can you do strategically to mitigate those challenges and barriers? So, you know, mobility internally, also externally, you know, getting patients out into the community to be able to see, you know, a cardiologist or an oncologist. There is healthcare costs related to the transportation. There's taking those correctional officers outside the facility to transport, where again, they may be already short staffed. So that brings safety risk of removing correctional officers. It's safety risk of bringing, you know, the patient outside the walls. So we're setting up telecardiology clinics, you know, in facilities right now. We're running those clinics and a lot of other specialty care inside the facility to bring that expertise inside the walls. And then when they need a certain test or intervention, you know, then we'll get them sent out, but we're able to screen for a lot of things, get them sent out for when they need certain tests. When they come back, able to manage things, keep their conditions under control. I mean, patients are always going to have exacerbations and they're going to have to go out, whether it's to a hospital or whatever. But, if we can do more to bring in the expertise to be able to mitigate those exacerbations and get them, you know, get their diabetes under control, you know, their CHF under control, so not having exacerbations or asthma, those types of things. It improves the overall care that we can deliver.
You know, it's interesting, and I think you've described this to me before, but the corrections population is a controlled population, and you control what goes in and out. And then you also control the finance, the cost of it as well. Where in the public healthcare, you've got payers all over the place. You got patients making their own decisions. You have less control. Where in this population, it is a lot more controlled, and you have a lot more control over what happens, what does and doesn't happen, which can affect outcomes. So you have more direct impact on outcomes. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, it's a great question because that was another reason. One of the variables that contributed to me coming over was I've always considered myself a population health geek. So I've when learning about it back in MHA school, over a decade ago, and I used to always tell my respiratory therapist, population health, value based payments, everything's going to be like this in the next 2 or 3 years. This is like 2010 or something like that, and here we are 12 years later, and it's like 38-40% of payments are in that type of model, and it's taken we've made a lot of leaps just to get there recently, but I've never been in more of a population health setting, so I'm like I keep I'm in love with this like model, but I've never really done it myself, and so I just thought like this is a great opportunity to be in that type of model where we have a lot of three big buckets, I would say. There's kind of like the pass-through contracts where the healthcare costs come in, and there's payment based on those costs. There's really like no or limited financial risk to us. There's then full risk where we're saying, hey, we're gonna take care of this population, and it's everything. It's like it's the cost of the doctors, cost of the nurses, often mental health, dentistry. The pharmaceuticals, the offsite trips, the ER visits, the hospital, all those different things could be included in that. And we're full risk for that, and then there's things in the middle that have different caps and stuff. And every contract's completely different. Some we have mental health, some we don't. Some, might be another company. Some states have, Medicaid expansion. So the cost of inpatient costs fall on the state where, if they don't, it would fall on, us under that situation. So there's different things like that. But yes, when you're in a more full risk type of situation, then all of a sudden it is our ability to say, okay, what tools can we use to provide the most effective, efficient healthcare to keep our patient population healthy? Because if they're going out, then that's, it's a negative to us if they're going to be hospitalized and things like that. If they need it, then we have to, do that. We want to do that, but we also want to make sure that we can keep them healthy. We want to prevent the exacerbations from happening. We want to identify things up front so they don't get worse down the line, I say, corrections get a bad rap, there's things that are not ideal. There's just like, they're not ideal in normal community healthcare that need to be improved. But those things don't change overnight. So that's a big mission of our organization in regards to improving the quality of care delivered. We actually recently got third party validation from NCQA for a lot of our population health programs in 5 different condition states like HIV, Hep C, right, hypertension, other things like that. Because again, we were the first in corrections to do that because we wanted that to be a foundation of moving forward. We're like, listen, we're going to have a third party that accredits groups like the Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic. We want that same type of overview and review on our clinical programs, which we got that, awarded, which was a great validation, a lot of the team's efforts. And we're going to start spreading those types of programs throughout the country. And again, it doesn't happen overnight, but it's humbling to be just a part of that.
Now, WellPath, do they get paid a set amount per covered life, and then it's up to them to it's up to the organization to figure out how you're going to spend that money
Every contract is so unique. I mean, every contract is so unique. There might be they talk about ADP as like an average daily population of how many patients are in a facility on average. So yeah, there may be contracts set up where there's a financial payment for a set number, and you're obligated to be able to take care of that patient population, and so because you have to match resources, right? If there's 20,000 patients versus 1,000 patients, obviously the resources and effort needed is significantly different. So you have to match those things. But yeah, it's so unique in regards to, I couldn't even begin to explain it because I don't have a full understanding myself beyond that every contract's unique, right? In some contracts, we have pharmaceutical costs and in some we don't. In some, a lot of our facilities, they're well-path nurses. In some states, they're not because it's a unionized state and it's state employees as nurses. And right. So it's our providers, you know, our doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants working alongside, you know, a state employee. So there's just a lot of uniqueness like that. And every state is different, just like in telehealth laws.
Yeah, absolutely. But telemedicine and what you're doing is looking at, okay, what can we do as an organization to reduce costs wherever and provide better quality care as well? It's not just about money. Yep. It's also about providing quality care through telehealth.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I'm always been a quality process improvement person at the core. And like, so one example of things that, you know, we've done is, I talked about transports out, where there would be, say on average, there's a facility that has 100 ER transportations. Typically out of those 100 transportations, 60 of those patients get evaluated and come right back to the facility. And so that's, you know, taxpayer money at the site, that's correctional officers leaving, that safety risk of pulling that, you know, patient outside the facility. There's just a lot of things that they're involved in that. You know, typically it's two correctional officers that go in those transports. So we developed a service called WellPath Now. It's an emergency medicine telehealth service where we're able to bring in emergency medicine expertise directly to the facility where our patients are located. So that way, you know, when we have exclusion criteria, like if they have stroke-like symptoms or in active labor, those types of things, you know, you don't use a service. You get them out to the ER immediately. But if there's any, like, we're not sure, we're thinking about sending them, bring in an emergency medicine provider, right? It's like bringing a virtual ED directly to their door to have that second opinion assistance. And so a lot of times it's a nurse initiates that call, but we've had physicians and nurse practitioners initiate that call saying, hey, I was thinking about sending this, but I'm thinking it might be something different. And then to be able to call in, you know, an ER physician with 30 years experience or whatever, and to be able to develop a treatment plan that's safe for the patient, you know, we've had a lot of success. We've done over 15,000 encounters. Wow. Over the last year and a half using that service. We're now in about 300 facilities across the country. And our providers, you know, they're able to respond to these emergencies on an average in less than 5 minutes. So typically it would take 30, 60 minutes or more before that patient would get in front of an ER provider and care would start.
Right.
And now they're getting in front of that ER provider in less than 5 minutes, you know? So it's like, it's things like that, that, it's cool to be a part of. And we put quality metrics all around all those things, right? It's like, okay, well, those patients that we're treating on site, how many of those are going off site, you know, within a 48-hour time period? And so we're monitoring that. And we know that patients will decompromise, you know, things like that. And so we monitor that, and that's, you know, maintain low single digits. And it's typically, it's part of the care plan. It's like, hey, let's give them this, you know, give them a bolus of fluid, this and that. But if their blood pressure stays at this level, they need to go out, right? So it gives the nurse clear direction on what to do. And we collaborate with the on-site staff. The service is nothing without that on-site collaboration to be able to say, hey, are you comfortable with this treatment plan, carrying out this treatment plan? Because we, you know, we've had scenarios. I remember this one early, and it's happened a couple of times where our provider would say, it's part of the script to make sure that they are comfortable, you know, that there's nothing that they know that the provider does not know in carrying out this plan. And so our providers always end, are you comfortable carrying out this treatment plan? And I remember one early scenario where a nurse was like, typically I would, but the plan called for the nurse to monitor the patient over like the next half hour, their vitals. And I think they were getting fluid or something, some medication. And the nurse said, typically I would, but I'm the only one here and I have to do a couple of cell side checks. So I can't stay with this patient and monitor them. And the provider said, well, that's fine. We'll send them out then. Oh. And the nurse was like, are you serious? Like they blew their mind. They just weren't ready for that. Like, yeah, if we cannot safely treat the patient on site, you are not comfortable with the treatment plan, then we will send them out. The safety of the patient will always come first in what we're doing. And, So, you know, once we got through some of those types of use cases, we had people that weren't sure about the service that became, you know, evangelical about the service and big advocates. I'm like, you guys got to use this. I thought it was something different. I thought they were going to stop me from, you know, sending things out, but they just help the process. They make it faster.
Yeah.
We've heard nurses say, you've allowed me to do more of what I know I can do, but you're allowed, you know, allowing me to use my skill sets to be able to treat patients. So it's, you know, it's exciting to see that, especially when you've got people on the ground that are, you know, like really excited to use it. We do a Net Promoter Score user experience for our nurses on site, and it's consistently above 70. And, and for those familiar, 70 to 100 is considered best in class. Yeah. So it's like really validates, you know, what we're seeing anecdotally played out in objective data.
Yeah. And, you know, it goes back to the concept of, is it the struggle between, is it telemedicine or in-person, right? Is it, it's not one or the other. It's really both together. And it's, sometimes it makes sense to do in-person and to take them there. Sometimes it doesn't. And telemedicine is better. And it's not what's better, one or the other. It's them together is actually the best, better than either of those two individually.
Yeah. I hate this whole thing that was created of, it's like telehealth versus in person. I'm like, when did this become like a UFC fight? You know, because your point, and there's starting to be emerging studies around this of, you know, a couple of things, one telehealth related, one not. One of like that combination of, you know, it's not telehealth or in person, but the combination of the two, that hybrid care of maximizing your resources to take care of the patient is better. You're seeing this play out in a provider kind of parallel of, you know, is our nurse practitioners good? Are they, you know, are doctors way better? And they're finding out, you know what, actually the best model is a team-based model of physician-led advanced practice provider teams taking care of patient populations. You know, so it's a similar type of like parallel that I've seen. And I think we'll see more of that because, you know, medicine has become so complex and, you know, so specific in different areas that you cannot, you're not in a position where, you know, the doctor can just see you at home on house calls. That same doctor is going to go into the inpatient and they've got inpatient privilege. They can see you there. They're going to do all of, you know, that same doctor's delivering your baby. Like but it's not that thing anymore yet. That's all those things are needed. So you need that level of cross collaboration between provider teams, and that's collaboration between provider teams, that's sharing, you know, data between provider teams to be able to improve the way we deliver care. And then hopefully, you know, by doing this and using more technology, we start to get patients more engaged in their own healthcare that has never been there in the past. You know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, we see how much engagement's happening with smartphones and social media with people. And if we can get that same type of connection and engagement with their own healthcare, invest in their own healthcare and communication with their physicians and providers, that will really be, I think, the next big tipping point of, you know, the evolution of how healthcare is delivered in the U.S.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. I often like to ask my guests, what does healthcare look like 10 years from now? And is a perfect segue. What does, in your mind, what does ideal healthcare look like 10 years from now? And what do we need to do different that we're not doing now to get to that point?
Yeah, I think a lot of different things. I think one, kind of to the point I was saying, I think, you know, it's going to be increasingly more patient-centric. You start to hear a lot more about, you know, as opposed to, you know, come to the provider's office, come here. It was very provider centric. It's going to be increasingly more patient centric, but still provider led, you know, provider leading the strategy to make it, you know, patient centric. A lot more data exchange. So we need more, the more data that's exchanged, the better typically for the patient, but also the more risk that comes along with that. So I think, you know, the increased or enhanced security of data and exchange of data for the benefit of the patients, increase in regards to, you know, artificial intelligence, natural language processing, machine learning, those types of things. We use some of that during the pandemic. where we were seeing, you know, early on the correlation between the words lost taste and smell with positive patients at COVID-19 through a natural language processing application that we used at MUSC, which allowed us to put those words into the virtual origin screening or questions specific to that in the virtual origin screening, you know, evolution of that. So you're going to see a lot more of that, you know, just, you know, a lot more precision medicine and those types of things. So it'll be interesting, you know, and even like remote patient monitoring, it's happening right now, but it is so in its infancy, you know. It's so I think there has to be a lot worked out in regards to, there is the, hey, we're going to pilot this, give you devices, because it's so at a pilot stage now. I mean, MUSC is doing some great work with like diabetes, where they're doing, you know, 500-700 patients at a time, but most people don't have things significant scale with remote patient monitoring. So I think you're going to see a lot of evolution of that over the next decade, and it's going to, it needs to weed out the devices that have not been validated, that are not secure, you know. And, you know, we've talked a lot at MUSC previously about, you know, a digital health formulary, you know, because you've got all these applications, you know, online now, and many of them have not been tested and validated. There's some great work over in Europe right now with the company that does a lot of this, of validating different healthcare applications. To be able to say, because health organizations need to set this up like a pharmacy, right? A pharmacy formulary where you say, hey, these are medications that we feel comfortable with, we've got access to them, and this is what we're going to prescribe our patients. You need to do the same thing from a digital health standpoint when you get into, you know, using different devices. Like, hey, these are devices that our team has validated, checked, and we have a process and purpose on how to use these devices to make sure we know what data is coming back into our health system. And out of that data, what is going into the legal medical record? What is just part of this designated record set? And so there's a lot of decisions that people have to make that a lot of organizations aren't even thinking about this stuff now. And they really need to start thinking about it before stuff gets out of hand. And all of a sudden you've got doctors using different applications across the health system. Patients want to send a doctor their device. You know, I'm pretty sure my doctor doesn't care how many steps I get every single day. They probably care that I'm active every day or active, you know, getting somewhat activity, you know, X days out of X months, you know, whatever that may be. And so I think, you know, having that data feeding dashboards in the future where you have nurses, and we do this right now with diabetes, so it's not like, hey, I have to monitor every single patient. You're monitoring a dashboard maybe of 1,000 patients, and out of that 1,000 patients, 200 or 180 or so are highlighted red for outside the norms, outside the blood pressure that the physician specifically set for them, outside the glucose range that their physician specifically set for them. So then you can have more precise interventions with those patients. And that's the type of thing of becoming more efficient with the limited resources that we have and will continue to have over the next 5-10 years.
Yeah, really focus on the patients who need it most, and not necessarily waste your time, but spend too much time on patients that don't need as much focus.
Healthcare has been too often this just like even spread of effort across, you know, I mean, it's like, I've got this visit with you, I'm gonna spend, you know, maybe 7 minutes, because it's so, I supposed to be 15. I feel like it's always like a 7 minute, super quick, right? Yeah. So you go in the office and it's like a 7 minute visit with you, 7 minute visit with you. So they do that maybe through 20 patients. One of them is like a healthy surfer in their early 20s.
Yeah.
And one of them's got multiple chronic care conditions, you know, and you're spending like equal time with these people. One might just be chatting up. One's like, gosh, wish we had more time to spend together. But so it's that type of thing of right sizing the care for the patient populations, so you can make sure you've got more frequent engagement. So you're going to have that. You can't forget about the healthy population. Right. So you have to have some level of engagement with them. And some of that might be virtual urgent care. You might need to have things, the system set up to make sure they have reminders about, you know, colonoscopy screenings and, you know, different things that come up, get your flu vaccine, that type of engagement, versus the other side of the spectrum where you might have, you know, a diabetic CHF patient that needs remote patient monitoring or devices to keep a closer connection to that patient.
Sean, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely, man. I always enjoy talking with you.